After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest right now? Are you feeling lonely, unappreciated, or misunderstood? When you keep these feelings bottled up, they can affect you negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's a great way to increase your self-awareness, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
Welcome to Dale Borglum's Healing at the Edge. We are very happy to share with you Dale's profound insight and open heart. Please go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/Dale to support this podcast.
Hello there. Welcome to the second episode of Meeting with the Spiritual Masters. My name is Chris Britt. I'm the host of the episode. And today I am once again with Dale Borglum, the director of the Living Dying Project. And Dale, I'd like to welcome you here. Thanks for joining us again.
Great to be back. We had so much fun the first time.
We did. I've known Dale for, I think, 7 years, and there's a lot of stories I haven't heard before. So last time we covered Neem Karoli Baba, Suzuki Roshi, Ananda Mai Ma, and the Dalai Lama. But as you mentioned, you've had many teachers in your life, and we're not going to go through the rest of them. There's innumerable teachers you have, but we did come up with a list of those to talk about. So before we start, anything to cover, Dale?
I don't know what to say. I mean, basically, we're just telling stories about enlightened masters that I've had the great grace to be with during this life. And there are a whole bunch of them that we're not going to be talking about, not because they're not great beings, but because I didn't have necessarily the same personal relationship where there are all kinds of stories involved. You know, I'd be with Kala Rinpoche, and it was very formal, for instance, and he certainly initiated me. In fact, I could even start. I could tell you a Kala Rinpoche story. When I was going to say there were not any Kala Rinpoche stories, but there's a practice called Tonglen. I don't know if you've heard of that. It's also called taking and sending. It's a Buddhist practice where you, instead of breathing in the good stuff and breathing out the bad stuff, taking in love and grace and breathing out toxicity, through deep compassion, you breathe in the suffering of others and you breathe out loving kindness to that person. You breathe out healing. And I was taught this exercise by Kala Rinpoche. And when I first heard about it, I thought, I don't want anything to do with that. That's for masochists and codependent fools. Not me. But after a while, after spending some time with him, I really trusted him completely. I decided I would do this practice. So I was teaching a workshop in San Francisco at that place right by the water. Oh, man, I can't remember the name of it.
Fort Mason?
Fort Mason, exactly. And we taught the work. So when you teach Tonglen, there's a visualization that comes along with it. And the visualization is you breathe in the negativity as hot, dark smoke, and you breathe out the healing as cool white light. Okay, so we did the exercise and we took a break and we came outside at Fort Mason and all this hot dark smoke and ashes were pouring down. It was the day of the Oakland fire. And, but it was so strange because the first time I taught this exercise and right after I taught it, the smoke came pouring down. I thought, this is a very powerful exercise. Obviously, there was just a coincidence, but it was just quite remarkable.
Right. So where were you when you met him? Were you in the States?
Yeah, that was at various places in the Bay Area after I came back from India. San Francisco, somewhere down the peninsula. He came to Marin, I think. I met him any number of times. He was one of the Dalai Lama's meditation teachers. A very, very beautiful soul, for sure.
Mm. All right. Great. Well, we touched upon him. And let's start with Goenka. Is it S.N. Goenka? And would you tell me about what teacher you were with before, perhaps, if you remember? Where were you? First impressions, etc.
So I got my PhD in math. I went to India. I ended up with Maharaji. And my mind was still kind of a turmoil from all that mathematics. It wasn't really calming down. And I thought, you know, if I could do some Buddhist meditation, maybe I could calm down and I could get closer to Maharaji. So I came to Maharaji and said, I hear there's this Buddhist teacher, Goenka. Can I go and study with him? And he said, if you wish. He was not very enthusiastic about it. He's probably thinking, why does he want to go be with that guy when he could be with me? But I don't know. He just said, okay. So I went to Goenka and I did 40 days of straight meditation, actually four 10-day retreats. And he teaches a very intensive Vipassana practice where there's no walking. It's just sitting on the cushion, essentially being with the sensations in your body hour after hour after hour. My mind got so focused at the end of this that I was only sleeping about 4 hours a night. And I was like meditating about 18 hours a day. And the rest was like eating and doing a few different things. But Goenka was really famous for his loving kindness. He had a very strong metta, it's called, metta loving kindness practice. And I really remember going in for an individual interview with him and the quality of loving kindness that was pouring out of him as I was walking in the door felt like I was actually leaning into a strong headwind. I could actually feel a physical force of love coming at me, that it was so powerful. I mean, it kind of shocked me that I could actually feel it in my body. And Goenka, this isn't the story so much about him as about me, but I was really into the practice. And as the weeks went by, it got more and more intense. My practice got stronger. And he could sense that something was ripe in me. And he gave me a private room to practice in. So I went into this private room, which is right next to the main meditation hall. And I meditated for an hour. And I went into this remarkable place. The mind completely stopped. There was only space. And at the end of it, it was blissful. And I thought, maybe I'm enlightened. This is fantastic. And I got out of the room. I had to walk through the main meditation hall to get from where I was to the dining room. And as I'm walking to the dining room, another meditator stood up and bumped into me. And my first thought was, do you know who you just bumped into? I'm enlightened. And I realized, I guess I'm not enlightened. So that was a little disappointing.
And this was the Vipassana training?
It was Vipassana at a place called Bodh Gaya in India. It's the place where the Buddha got enlightened. And under the Bodhi tree, it was at the Burmese Vihar, the Burmese temple in Bodh Gaya, India. There was a huge, big storm that knocked the tent down. A lot of us were in a tent on top of the building. And there was a cold snap. It was in January. And generally in this part of India, it never gets particularly cold, but it got so cold that a lot of the homeless people were freezing to death. Hmm. And I had on, it was so cold and I wasn't really prepared for it. So I was sleeping with every article of clothing I had. I had two pairs of socks on my hands and on my feet, and I had every shirt on. And I still, it was like so cold. I had to really just relax to be able to sleep. I was so cold.
So, and is Vipassana synonymous with insight meditation?
Essentially, yes, it is.
Okay. And for those who don't know, including myself, I haven't done any extensive retreats. I've done some day-longs at the Spirit Rock.
Yeah.
Just down the road. The foundation of Vipassana is awareness, or in awareness is foundational in some of the other types of meditation that you teach. Is that, could you just speak a little bit to what Vipassana is and how it benefits someone for those just tuning in?
So Vipassana is about cultivating mindfulness, a balanced, centered awareness in the present, so that you can begin to see how suffering arises. As you know, running the Living Dying Project, I work with people who are suffering. People who are dying, people with pain in their body, people who are grieving. And cancer does not cause suffering. Resistance to cancer causes suffering. Physical pain does not cause suffering. Resistance to physical pain causes suffering. So usually when we're having a hard time, we're feeling fear or anger, some difficult emotion, we fixate on the trigger. I'm angry because of the political turmoil that's going on right now. Right now we're talking 2 days after the election, you and me. So it's crazy times, right? Right. So, Republicans are blaming the Democrats, stealing the election. The Democrats are blaming the Republicans for whatever they're doing. And instead of, what does it feel like to be angry? Hmm. What does it feel like to be frightened? It's you out there who's causing me to feel this. So Vipassana is really essentially learning to withdraw all that blame and be aware of, in a very direct, intimate, almost naked way, what it feels like to have emotions, what it feels like to breathe, what it feels like to have a thought. So that very often we don't experience things. I remember directly, we don't experience our body. We experience concepts of our body. We don't experience our mind directly. We experience concepts of our mind. I remember at the end of a Vipassana retreat down in Yucca Valley in Southern California, mind was really very focused and clear. And for breakfast, we had grapefruit sections along with some other things, oatmeal or something, I don't know. And as I very mindfully started eating this piece of grapefruit, and I put it into my mouth and bit into it. The grapefruit, which is made up of tiny little sacks of grapefruit juice, right? They were exploding in my mouth. It was like ecstatic. And I realized I'd never really fully tasted a grapefruit. Like you start biting into it, you say, oh, this is a pretty good one, or it's a little dry. And then you go back to thinking about life or something. But like to really eat the piece of grapefruit was just remarkable. It was almost blissful. So that anything, if you're really doing it, walking or breathing or eating a grapefruit or getting angry at somebody, if you're completely present, then you're alive. There's an awakeness. So that Vipassana is about going beyond all the concepts and really settling into what is actually happening.
Sounds like, before we move on to another teacher, I've had an experience with just a real vivid taste of a blueberry. And now when I eat a blueberry I have an awareness sometime, a reflection that I'm so far from that state. There's such a distance between that there and now, or there appears to be, and that causes some suffering for me. And so for me or anybody else who's in that, I imagine you have to have the presence of mind to be with compassion, I guess, or at least, or what approach would you take to deal with that present moment of a memory that's clearer state?
So that's a great question. And I didn't really answer the previous question. We got slightly sidetracked. You said, is Vipassana part of the meditation you teach? And compassion, which you just mentioned that you might have for not being able to taste your blueberry very fully, compassion is the open heart meeting suffering. But the open heart can't meet the suffering until you have enough awareness, mindfulness, to be mindful of the suffering. So in a way, the mindfulness practice precedes the ability to open the heart and have loving kindness or gratitude or compassion. So I had some other things I was going to say there. So you were trying to eat the blueberry.
Right. I mean, you've had these experiences. When you had your grapefruit this morning, was it bursting in your mouth? And if it did, you don't carry that all the time into your life, I imagine.
I don't. Yeah. And certainly my mindfulness isn't as strong when I've been just spending the day like I have today on the computer and talking to clients and running around town and things like that, as if I were at the end of a long meditation retreat. Suzuki Roshi, who we talked about last time, had this wonderful quote where he said, "The most important thing is finding the most important thing." So if you think the most important thing is being awake so that you can taste your grapefruit and look at your friend with love and be present in your body and in your life, that's one thing. If you think the most important thing is just being happy and pushing suffering away and avoiding too much turmoil, then what we're talking about here doesn't make too much sense. So like in Tibetan Buddhism, before you even begin the mindfulness practice, they ask you to do some contemplations to create motivation. Like one of them is, you're going to die, but you don't know when. What could be more obvious intellectually, right? But if you and I didn't know we were going to survive to the end of this interview, right? And we don't, do we really? I mean, do we really know? We don't know. Right. But if we really didn't know that, how much more connected would we be if we thought, this is the last interaction of my life. This is it, me and Chris, right?
I am staring into the white light right now, but it's a softbox made for shooting video. So hopefully this isn't it.
Why hopefully?
It just doesn't look as bright as 10,000 suns.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So you were saying... I don't know what you were saying. I stopped. I got you in the middle of that. Well, you know what? You remind me of that great quote about rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic.
Yeah. So, I mean, in a way, what we're saying is, let me go back a sentence here. So I was saying before, cancer doesn't cause suffering. Resistance to cancer causes suffering, right? Divorce doesn't cause suffering. Resistance to divorce causes suffering. And I'm not saying that almost every human being isn't going to suffer if they have cancer or if they get divorced. But it's very difficult to heal the suffering if you're not aware of how it's arising, where it's coming from. It's coming from grasping. It's coming from rejecting the present moment and wanting to be different. So if we have a strong enough motivation, which comes to most people only because they're suffering so much, then whatever's arising, the political turmoil or the pandemic or how crappy the weather has been in California this summer, all the fires and the smoke and the drought and everything that's going on, all that stuff is going on. Can that be motivation to awaken? Or do we say, oh, this is too much. I'm gonna dive into Netflix. One person wrote that her biggest fear in the pandemic was she'd reach the end of Netflix. She'd seen everything on Netflix. It was all done. That's a lot of Netflix.
Yeah. You know, people talk about Netflix, binging on Netflix, binging, like Netflix binging.
Right.
Or taking a lot, I would call it taking a life fast, you know, the opposite of binging. So yeah, and that quote you used about, it was in one of the meditations about, instead of trying to rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic, do you have the motivation to go into your suffering in a productive way? I'm paraphrasing that. Is that what this is, this whole, we're not masochists here in terms of wanting to feel suffering, but to get happy from that, right? I mean, to liberate it from the nature of suffering I want to suffer in a new way. I'm tired. I see the old patterns of my suffering. So I won't ask for anything new. Suffering will come my way, I'm sure. So
what I'm saying here, though, Chris, is that we're not trying to go into suffering. We're trying to go into our lives. We're trying to go into the present. And suffering will be there until we're free, until we're liberated. So it's not like you're looking for suffering.
Right.
Life will present it moment to moment. It's not a masochistic thing. It's not trying to find suffering. It's trying to be how awake, how loving, how present, how embodied can I be moment to moment to moment?
Right.
How alive are you willing to be?
So let's choose another person to talk about here. We could talk about the 16th Karmapa. We didn't cover the 16th. Yeah, why don't we start there?
So after I came back to America, even though I'd been with Maharaji, who was not a Tibetan Buddhist, the best teachers that seemed to be coming to America at that point were these really fantastic Tibetan Buddhists. There was the Dalai Lama, who we talked about last week. There was the 16th Karmapa, who's since died. Now there's the 17th Karmapa. There's Dujin Rinpoche, Dingo Kensei, Sakya Trinzen, the heads of all the main schools of Tibetan Buddhism. And His Holiness, the 16th Karmapa, I saw him a few times do this thing called the black hat ceremony, where he put on this big black, it's almost like a crown. It's hard to describe it really, very elaborate big hat. And as he put it on, though, he would go into an entirely, he became a different person. He was doing some internal thing where he became a deity. And he would do that right in front of a room full of people. So here's this guy, this very, very wonderful man, very loving, kind, jovial guy. And he'd do this thing. And all of a sudden, it was like you were transported to another realm of consciousness just by him doing that. And both Dujin Rinpoche and the 16th Karmapa, the first time they met me, the first time I met them, they started laughing at me. They came into the room, they took one look, there's like dozens, hundreds of people in the room. They looked right at me and they started laughing.
What do you think that was about?
Well, they never said, but the feeling I got, I mean, it was not like a mean laugh. It was kind of like, oh, there you are this life. That's funny. I mean, like they were remembering from a time back whenever that we were like, I don't know, like we were not neurotic Westerners, right? I'm just guessing here, but it's just felt like that they saw me in this particular incarnation. They thought it was quite amusing. But that's really an interesting notion that here we are. We're so busy being who we are. Here it is, 2020, and there's the election going on and the pandemic, and we have families and children and jobs and lovers and enemies and all this stuff going on. And we take it all so seriously. And then there's the Karmapa looking at me. He just laughs. Oh, you're in that life.
Right.
You know, I mean, can we look at ourselves that way and not take our incarnation quite so seriously?
And this makes me think, a lot of people listening to this, maybe not those who are drawn to this particular podcast, says, well, there is suffering there. This is real. This is really real. And my suffering's justified. You know, I was talking to someone today and she says, I can't wait for the election results to fully come in and this be over. And I'm thinking, personally, I've been reflecting on what in my life do I think needs to change for me to be happy. And I feel like happiness is the way. I mean, cultivating, it's hard to explain for myself, but to be less dependent on circumstances, there is a freedom there to be less dependent on that. That's the approach I'm feeling as I do more meditation work. My mind is orienting in that way. That's how I'd put it. I don't know what you get from when I say that.
So your friend is looking for the election to be done so she can stop worrying about or being anxious or whatever it might be. But I guarantee you that after the election's done and that calms down, she's going to find something else to be concerned about. And as long as we're grasping at happiness, we're having to judge each arising experience. Is it a happy-making one, or is it a not happy-making one? So that we're kind of like one step removed from an intimate relationship with our experience, because we're trying to find the happy-making ones. Whereas on the other hand, if what we want is truth, if what we want is aliveness, beingness, then that includes suffering, and not suffering includes everything. Yeah. But eventually, as a side effect, we find a joy that transcends happiness and sadness. Happiness and sadness are just part of the human experience. They're not good or bad. I mean, obviously, happiness is in a way more pleasurable than sadness. Although Maharaji would say, I love sadness. I feel closer to God when I'm sad. Hmm. So it's not that sadness is a bad thing. It's that we tend to get caught in it. We tend to identify, I'm sad or I'm afraid. Once again, in English, we say, I am afraid. In Spanish, we say essentially, I have fear. And in Tibetan, we say, fear is here. So it's just the way we think and language things.
That's much more spacious.
Yeah, it's so contracted in the way we do it in English.
Right.
So that your friend, through her life experience, will eventually get to the point where she gets tired of going back and forth between grasping at happiness. You're happy for a little while and it's gone, and you try to find it again, and the election's done, but then there's the next thing, and then the pandemic, and then the relationship, and then the money. This is on and on it goes, right? And eventually you get tired of suffering. You say, why am I suffering? What's going on here? What is the nature of reality? Who am I?
Right.
And that's where the Vipassana comes in. You start just by watching your breath. You see how the grasping at certain experiences causes suffering.
So, Trump or Rinpoche? Do you like my transitions, Dale?
No, I'm just laughing when I think of Trungpa, because there's so many stories about him. Trungpa Rinpoche.
And
yes.
Who is Trungpa? And it starts with that as well. And where were you, etc.
So Trungpa was one of these guys that was coming to the Bay Area. He was famous for showing up at his talks like an hour or two late. And he'd be a bit inebriated when he showed up or something. Whereas the Karmapa and the Dalai Lama and Dujin Rinpoche, all these other people were much more formal and together in a certain way. But eventually then Trungpa founded the first Buddhist university in America called Naropa University. And he invited Ram Dass to teach a course there at the first summer at Naropa University. So this was in 1974, about less than a year after Maharaji left his body. So Ram Dass and me and about 8 or 10 other people went to Boulder, Krishna Dass and Chai Utal and Rameshwar Dass and Dwarka, a whole bunch of our satsang went there to teach this class with Ram Dass. He was like the professor. We were like the teaching assistants. And he would teach on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And Trungpa would teach Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. Maybe it was the other way. They each had like 1,000 people in the class. And they were like dueling teachers. And it was just quite a remarkable time. But Trungpa was this very rascally kind of guy. He taught crazy wisdom. It wasn't about keeping it together and where it's being religious and spiritual, is whatever you can do to become free. And in those days, a lot of people on the spiritual path wore white clothes. We had spiritual names. We tried to be kind of holy. And he was, I think, by being sort of roguish and drinking and womanizing and things, showing people that there's not one way to be spiritual, that if you're really meditating, if you're really focused on your practice, then whatever you're doing will be bringing you to being closer to the end of the path. That sentence didn't come out right now, but you hear what I'm saying.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question. This could be a whole podcast about just the term spiritual path. I have a sense of what it means for me now, but I've heard it said a lot, and some people think, well, what is the path? Where does it go? And when you die, does the path end? Can you say rather succinctly as not to, I know I'm asking the question, but not to, there's probably another person to talk about. Could you say something about the concept of spiritual path?
This is such a big question, Chris, and it kind of takes away talking about the masters. But
okay, another episode.
A way they say that the goal is the path. The path isn't to get somewhere. The notion of enlightenment is realizing that who we are right now is already whole. And yes, you're suffering, and I'm suffering, and your friend who wants the election to be done, the results that come in is suffering. But enlightenment ultimately is realizing that there's nothing to achieve that isn't already here. It's called the pathless path or the goalless path. We create the path by walking in it. It's not like there's something out there that we're going toward, but that as we're moving forward, it seems like moving somewhere, although we're maybe not getting anywhere, that just by having the motivation, having the intention to be free, of trying to utilize our life experience as a way of seeing how suffering is creating and how we can have compassion for suffering rather than automatically rejecting it. And out of that compassion, finding a spaciousness, then it's all the path. There's nothing needs to be fixed or changed or thrown away. Suzuki Roshi, once again, who we talked about last week, had this other super great quote where he said, "We're all perfect, but there's still room for improvement." Right? So we're all perfect. There's nothing to achieve. But at the personality level, at the body level, yeah, when somebody punches you in the nose, it hurts. When you burn your finger, it hurts. When you get sick, it hurts. I'm preparing a talk for this post-election webinar that we're having in a few days here. And I was reading some old notes, and there was this article in the paper about how they're teaching mindfulness in the elementary schools in Oakland. And they asked a young boy who was a meditator, "What does meditating mean to you?" And he said, "What it means to me is when I get angry and want to punch the other boy in the nose, I don't." that there's that gap between the impulse arising and feeling the impulse, feeling the anger, and instead of acting, just saying, okay, I can just be with this feeling without doing a crazy thing.
Okay. So back to Trumpa. I took us off the path for a spiritual path, although it's all the same.
Right.
Yeah. So tell me, so you were saying there was Ram Dass teaching some nights and then Trumpa teaching the other nights, and Trumpa was trying to show everyone that perhaps their way wasn't the only way. At least that's how I'm paraphrasing it. But any stories particular about your experience with Trumpa Rinpoche?
Well, he would give these, as I say, he would give these lectures. There's like about 1,000 people, I think, in the room. I don't know. It's like a huge room, all full of people. Maybe I'm exaggerating. It was a lot of people. And a couple things I noticed. One was that the dumber the question was, so at the end of a talk, you say, "Does anybody have any questions?" So out of 1,000 people, there's going to be some really dumb questions. And particularly since this was the very beginning of all of the stuff being talked about in the West. But what I noticed was that the dumber the question was, the more brilliant and pithy the response was. But if somebody, on the other hand, had this really elaborate, subtle question, he gave kind of a offhand response to it. So that I don't know quite what that meant, but it's kind of showing that you don't have to overthink it. Just, okay, here it is. So one night he gave this talk, and he's up on the stage, and next to him is a carafe that looks like it has water in it, but it's sake, right? So all night he's got his glass, and he's pouring sake in, and he's drinking away as the talk goes on. And the talk was so brilliant that at the end of the talk, when I went outside, the leaves of the trees were glowing with consciousness. I was in this like altered state. But at the same time, when he got up from the talk, he fell over drunk. Right? And there was a paper making its rounds among the teachers that he had written called On Conscious Drinking, not unconscious, but On Conscious Drinking. And what he said is that if you remain really, really mindful as you're imbibing alcohol, that you don't need to get drunk in the same way, that you don't need to become inebriated in this common way. So I had a girlfriend at the time. I won't mention her name. She'll be grateful for that. She was a fantastic meditator. We got a big bottle of sake. We put it down between us. And we started meditating. And every 10 minutes or so, we'd take a big slug of sake, right? At the end of an hour, it felt like I was on psychedelics. My mind had completely dissolved. The ego was nowhere to be found. It's this incredible meditation. And yet when I got up to go to the bathroom, my body was drunk, but my mind was completely clear. Hmm. I don't know what the point of that is, but for all you boys and girls out there. Okay. Here's another story about drunk, but I think it's just so funny. So he had different scenes. One of them was in Boulder, but he had a meditation place up at Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And to drive from Boulder, Colorado to Jackson Hole, Wyoming, it's just cowboy country. There's nothing in between those two places, but like cowboy bars and the Wild West. So he says to some of his students, we're going to have to drive up to Jackson Hole. A few of you guys get in the car, and we're going to drive up there during the night. So there's a handful of these guys. They're in this car, and partway up there in the middle of nowhere, he wants to stop at a cowboy bar. So they go into the bar, and as they come in, there's a bunch of cowboys there, and one of them makes a racist remark about the slant eye that just came in the door. Trumpet doesn't say anything. They sit down at the table, order some beers, whatever, drinks, I don't know. And when the guy who made the remark was about to take his next pool shot, they were playing pool, Trungpa got up to go to the bar to get another drink and seemingly accidentally bumped into the guy just as he was about to make a shot and ruin the guy's shot. And the guy got mad and said, what are you doing? Can't you pay attention? You know, I'm trying to, and Trungpa said, oh, you know, so little time goes by. The same thing happens. The guy's about to take a shot. Trungpa just lurches into him right at the perfect moment, ruins a shot. Now the guy's really upset. Okay. Some more time goes by. Trungpa does it the third time. This time the guy says, I've reached my limit. I've got a lot of friends here. You're in big trouble. And he starts coming toward Trungpa. And Trungpa pulls out a water pistol and squirts the guy right in the face. And the guy was so dumbfounded, he couldn't be angry. He didn't know what to do. I mean, Trunk was totally fearless. He didn't run away. He didn't get angry back. He shot him in the face with a water pistol.
Do you think there could be a moment of passion where after you get squirted in the face with water that you pull out your real pistol? And I don't think so. I think you'd just be so – I think it's so ridiculous. It's so funny that it would stop somebody in their tracks, it sounds like.
There's another story. I thought of the story when I was thinking about what we talk about tonight, and I was almost not going to tell it because I don't remember if it's about Trungpa or about Sokni Rinpoche. I think it was about Trungpa though. Anyway, he was younger. He was in Tibet. He had an attendant, and he and his attendant were walking from one monastery to the next. And as they're almost to the second monastery, they have to go by a house right by the road, just like 100 yards from the monastery. And to the front of this house is chained a huge Tibetan mastiff dog. I mean, these are huge dogs they have in Tibet for guarding the house. And the dog does not like people walking by his house. So the dog is like straining at the chain, growling like he wants to eat people alive. They just get past the house. The dog breaks the chain and he comes running at the two of them. The attendant makes a beeline for the gate of the monastery, hoping to get there before the dog bites him. And Trungpa sees the dog coming, and he starts running at the dog, barking. And the dog puts his tail between his legs and runs away, which is kind of the same story, that when fear arises, or when a fearful situation arises, do you have to get afraid, or you just say, okay, here's danger, and getting all panicked and upset about it is not the skillful way to deal with this. I mean, can we meet something head on?
There's one other person we wanted to cover, and I thought before we wrap up, we could cover, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing the name correctly. Is it Dujum Rinpoche?
Dujum Rinpoche is, I mentioned him as one of the two guys that laughed at me.
Oh, okay.
The first time he saw me. And he is the head of one of the four schools of Tibetan Buddhism, the Nyingma school, I believe it is. And he was a very powerful meditation teacher, greatly respected. Of course, he's since died. So let's just leave it that one story that he laughed at me. I didn't have much of a personal relationship with him. I just met him at a few empowerments. And the first time was the one where he started laughing at me. So I greatly loved him. And I had some friends who studied quite closely with him who had great, great respect for him. But I don't have any other personal stories.
All right. Well, I would call this an episode. And before we end, I will mention that my name is Chris Britt. I could have done that at the top. I think maybe I did. I blend magic and mindfulness and healing work together in an entertaining way to engage people. And I have a website, chrisbritt.com, chrisbritt.com. And Dale, if you'd like to tell a little bit about yourself for those who feel like they have a connection with what you're saying, would you say something?
Yeah, I'm the director of the Living Dying Project, which is an outgrowth of something that Ram Dass and Stephen Levine founded back in the late 70s, early 1980s, the beginning of the conscious dying movement, where we try to bring the Dharma to the encounter with life-threatening illness. My website is livingdying.org. There's a lot of great free information on it. It's the most complete site on the internet with information about conscious dying. A lot of what I do now is not so much about dying, but about the living part of living dying. I have meditation groups. I have people that I do spiritual counseling with. That's about it. I have some groups, but by the time this, because I do have a group every other Saturday, a free group, Saturday mornings, California time. It's got about 100 people in it. And I'm also having some training workshops in January and February with CEU continuing education units for California therapists, psychologists, social workers, acupuncturists, and nurses.
Fantastic. So I actually noticed we do have a commenting feature on here, and someone asked, is there a next episode? And I think I would love to do this again. And then there's a question, are questions acknowledged? And I think I will acknowledge that question by saying, yes, next time we'll make some time for some questions perhaps. And again, Dale, and by the way, the person who wrote that, please reach out and I'll take your question and we can see what we can do. Anyways, thank you again, Dale. Oh, go ahead.
Let me even say that if people have questions about some of the material I presented tonight, just go to the Living Dying Project website. The email address is there. The phone number is there. I'd be glad to respond to people.
Even better. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. It was great.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest right now? Are you feeling lonely, unappreciated, or misunderstood? When you keep these feelings bottled up, they can affect you negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's a great way to increase your self-awareness, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.